Welcome to the Oxford Sidebar Podcast for November 2015 from the Oxfordshire branch of the British Science Association. Our speaker this month was Dr. Helen Scales, who spoke about her book, Spirals in Time, Exploring the Scientific Wonders of Seashells. We hope you enjoy.
I'm really excited to be able to introduce Helen Scales, who's come across from Cambridge. Helen is a marine biologist and author, and I first heard her book on Radio 4. It was being serialised, and Helen was reading her own book, and it's absolutely fascinating. There's stories about marine biology, about research, about science. There's stories about the history of science, about the personalities that are involved in looking at seashells. There's stuff about jewellery, lots of myths and mythology. So Helen's going to give us a talk on her book, and there'll be the opportunity to ask questions and have a discussion afterwards. So,
brilliant. Thank you very much, and thank you so much for coming this evening. I'm Helen Scales, and just in case any of you are wondering, that is my real name. Sometimes the marine biology thing makes people think of it. Make up a name. It is my name. And this is my book, Spirals in Time, The Secret Life and Curious Afterlife of Seashells. And what I want to do this evening is just tell you a little bit about why I wrote the book, how I kind of came to the topic and what I wanted to do with it. And tell you a few of the stories that I write about and give you a bit of a flavour of what's inside. And then we'll have a chance to have any questions at all at the end. But I'm going to start off with the title, Spirals in Time, The Secret Life and Curious Afterlife. I'm going to come back to the main title, The Spirals, a bit later, but that subtitle was the subject of a comment on the Guardian website. So my book was reviewed very, very nicely in The Guardian. But I did that thing you're not supposed to do, which was read below the line in the comment section. And one of the people who put some ideas down felt it necessary to talk about the subtitle and refer to it as... So The Secret Life and Curious Afterlife of Seashells is clearly the kind of twee and infantilised title that publishers of popular science books like this impose on a book, probably against the author's wishes, simply to tell readers that this book won't be too difficult to read and the content will be nice and simple. It wasn't the publisher's idea to have The Secret Life and Curious Afterlife, it was actually my mum. And I'm really pleased that she did help me with the subtitle for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I'm rubbish at titles, absolutely terrible. Currently trying to decide what to call my next book. I just don't know. So if anyone has any thoughts, perhaps in the pub afterwards, you would get. I'll dedicate the book to you. Seriously, you can come up with a good title. I'll tell you what it's about later. But no, I'm rubbish at titles, and it was a real pain because we had a running title as I was writing the book. Which we then, me and my editor, just thought, oh, no, that didn't work. So we threw that out, and there was a big gap when there was no title, and we didn't know what to call it. But my mum kind of stepped into the breach with the subtitle. We thought maybe it could be the main title, but then we thought, subtitle is fine, Secret Life of Curious Afterlife. So the second reason I was really pleased she came up with it is because it showed me that she really understood what the book is about. And from me talking about it and blaring on about shells and mollusks and getting her to read parts of the book as well, she got what it is that I was trying to do, which is twofold. So I wanted to write about the lives of the animals that make a shell. So that was the secret life part. Is I wanted to take these objects that people, we find shells on the beach, these beautiful spiraling things, objects, and we perhaps don't necessarily think that much about where those things have come from and what has made them. And what I wanted to do with the book was really bring to life the animals that make seashells. And I also decided really that I'd take what I consider to be the supreme shell makers of the oceans, the mollusks. There are other creatures that do make shells. Crabs make shells of a different kind. There are plankton that make tiny little shells out of other things. But my book is about the mollusks that make these beautiful objects that we would generally recognise as seashells, mainly calcium carbonate. It's a group of animals that have been around for at least half a billion years. They evolved first in the deepest ocean. They are among some of the strangest, oldest, toughest and smartest creatures on the planet. And I really wanted to bring them to life. I wanted to just kind of find the wonder in mollusks. ranging from familiar things, snails and slugs, not all of them have shells, some of them have lost their shells, octopus and squid, through to strange creatures, strange ones that perhaps you haven't necessarily seen or heard of, things like chitons, which stick themselves to rocks and look a bit like a woodlouse, and if you knock them off, they roll up in a ball like an armadillo. There are weird mollusks that live in the deep sea that look like worms. There are argonauts, there are sea butterflies, there are kind of stranger members of the mollusk world. So I wanted to kind of just uncover the lives of mollusks. So that was the sort of first bit of the book. And then the other side is the afterlife, the curious afterlife. Now, this isn't the bit where I talk about mollusk ghosts. It's not that kind of afterlife. That's another book. No, this, what I really, that bit is getting at the idea of how people have used shells that are left behind after mollusks have died. So it's kind of it's carrying on that keeping the afterlife of inhuman world of the shells themselves. So I really wanted to explore all the extraordinary things that people have done with shells. It really goes back a long, long way. Our relationship with shells kind of comes from almost the dawn of humanity. 125,000 years ago, people, early humans, were making necklaces out of shells, having this sort of symbolism, which was something different to previous, what came before. It was showing that people were starting to think in quite a modern way about the world, about themselves, and using things as decorations, not simply as useful tools. They were actually something symbolic. I don't know what, but they were symbolising something. So that's the other side of the book, really, is the incredible uses that humans have had for shells for thousands of years. Uses like this. So this is the grave of a 6,500-year-old man. He was discovered in Bulgaria, not far from the coast of the Black Sea. And he dates back to a time called Old Europe. And up until the discovery of this grave and about 300 similar ones like it, it was thought that at this time that people living in Europe were kind of very egalitarian. They were pastoralists who, up until this point, there was not really any sign of a rich elite. Everyone was kind of just getting on farming and that was all, you know, there wasn't a great difference between people. And then they found these opulent graves full of gold. And it was it still is the oldest buried gold treasure that's been found in Europe. And there were clearly leaders in this community, and this was the kind of the chief leader, this guy here, who were the guys who were buried with treasure, frankly. All sorts of gold and things, bangles and so on. But not just gold. You can just see around his arm here this white bangle. And that's made from a shell called Spondylus, otherwise known as the thorny oyster. And they are quite beautiful big shells that live in the Mediterranean. They're covered in spines, but underneath is this dense white skeleton. And Spondylus is a material that was used to make jewellery. And a lot of the time, these bangles, they were carved into these solid bangles. And they've been found all across Europe, and beads and all sorts of things made of these shells that came from the Mediterranean and were traded all across Europe for hundreds of years. And this one in particular, I wanted to tell the story about this one because it's kind of weird. We don't quite know why this happened and what it meant, but it was clearly something very powerful. This guy had a Spondylus bangle that was deliberately, but it was carved, it would have taken hours to produce in the first place, but it was deliberately broken and then fixed with gold plates. You can just see on the other side some beautifully kind of embossed gold plates were used to fix this bangle. And it was then put on his arm. And I believe this is one of the ones which they've measured, like archaeologists have measured up and figured that actually he probably couldn't have taken it back off again. It probably was put on at a young age and he grew into it, and it might have just been a permanent fixture on his arm. But why it was broken, there were other objects in a similar sort of time that were deliberately smashed and buried with people. They clearly had some kind of meaning for the afterlife, which we don't really know, but I find it just kind of deeply fascinating that there is the possibility that these shells were considered to be as valuable as the gold stuff he was buried with as well. Including, and I'm sure you've all noticed this already, but yes, he's got gold pieces. That was one of the things that he did in these extraordinary graves from thousands of years ago. So the book also has various stories of the uses of shells, you know, dating back thousands of years up to the present day. And one of the things I want to do in the book is to try and reinstate some of the wonder and the glory in seashells that I think perhaps is slipping a bit from our view at the moment. and that shells, seashells, have kind of taken on a bit more of a sense of kitschy objects that sort of if you buy in a store on the beach and don't think that much about where they came from, and frankly make things like this, which, you know, I think is a million miles from a beautifully carved symbolic bangle buried with a great chief. Things like this. I spent some time looking around for the ugliest things I could find on the internet, and there's lots of them made from shells. And this disaster of a thing, actually for sale on eBay, if any of you are interested. For some reason, it hasn't been bought yet. I think it's about £500. I really wanted to try and remind people or show readers that there is a kind of an elegance to shells that perhaps isn't always remembered today. And lots of wonderful things that people in the past and the present have done with shells and things that mollusks leave behind after they die. There we go. So the science in the book was one thing that was constantly surprising me when I was writing and researching the book. I mean, I'm a marine biologist, I've studied all sorts of aspects of the ocean and worked in conservation. So I know, you know, already knew a fair amount about mollusks, but new stuff is coming up all the time. And I've really found that there was this kind of incredible new wave of discoveries and findings in the mollusk world and to do with shells, which was a really kind of exciting and rich thing to tap into when I was writing. So just all sorts of lovely stories of things that we're discovering about these animals, even familiar things that have been around for ages. This is a blue ray limpet. You can find these around the British coast living at the bottom of seaweed. Really beautiful, really tiny, about the size of a little finger, maybe normal fingernail. And one thing that recently came out was that limpets in general, there's a whole group of sea snails that are limpets, that they have their teeth are made of the strongest material known, biological material. They knock spider silk off the perch. And the reason they have these incredibly strong teeth is because a lot of limpets spend their lives rasping at rocks with their teeth to scrape down sort of films of green seaweed films. And the rocks, they need incredibly strong teeth so they don't just shatter. So that's a really cool discovery that came out this year. But these guys, the blue ray limpets, have these beautiful blue stripes across their back. They really do look like they're glowing in the dark. But they aren't actually making light. They aren't bioluminescent, as many organisms are, but these guys aren't making light, but they're reflecting it back in a certain way to produce these beautiful lines. And just a few months ago, a paper came out from some guys who... we're looking at the structure of these shells and to try and understand where this colour comes from. And they've basically nailed it down to the structure of the calcium carbonate in the blue ray limpet shells. And it's got a sort of nano structure. I don't know the absolute details, but it's something about the wavy structure of the arrangement of the calcium carbonate crystals means that as incident light bounces on it, it absorbs everything apart from this particular wavelength of blue, which is then reflected back. Get these beautiful, beautiful stripes, even in quite low light, so almost it is like they're kind of gathering the light in and throwing it back out again. And as lovely as that is, it's also potentially quite useful, and it's been said that perhaps this could lead the way to next generation of things like heads-up displays and screen, carbon screens, which can put maps and things in front of you and that kind of stuff. You know, augmented reality could perhaps be inspired by these little snails that live on seaweed around the British Isles. And there's tons of other really awesome discoveries coming out of the mollusk world. There are new medicines being inspired by cone snails, which are tropical snails, little things that can hunt fish. A slow-moving snail that has the ability to hunt fast-moving fish. It seems impossible, but they have these incredibly potent toxins. They fire their teeth out at fish that wander past, actually usually when they're asleep, so but they contain a cocktail of incredibly complex poisons of up to 200 individual different peptides, bits of protein, essentially, in their spit that act as that basically paralyse the fish and stop them from moving instantly by blocking various channels in their nervous system. And we've known about this for a little while, and all sorts of research tools have come out of this discovery because it turns out that those peptides also can block various parts of our nervous systems as mammals. And it's an incredibly useful tool because you can basically reach into a nervous system of an animal and switch off different bits and see how it works. So, you know, research labs all across the world are now using cone snail venom as a tool in neuroscience and all sorts of research. and they're being made into medicines. Like one in particular, I think, is already being used in America as a painkiller because it blocks the I think it's how the spinal cord communicates pain signals to the brain, and essentially just blocks those channels. And it's a very effective painkiller for people who are suffering from chronic pain, and it's less addictive than morphine, and very effective. So loads of really cool discoveries are coming out in the modern world. And so I tried to cram as many in the book as I could. And then there came a point where my editor was like, that's it, we have to stop and we have to print this. But it's sort of, it's amazing. I was really kind of just overwhelmed by all the sorts of different areas of science that are using mollusks and studying them and finding new species. It's all very wonderful. But one of the things I also wanted to do in the book was to look into the past at the kind of history of ideas that mollusks and shells have helped us, or just kind of inspired in people. And one in particular is the stories of the people, the scientists and the thinkers who have wondered about the shape of seashells. And how it is that they have these beautiful spiralling shapes in all sorts of different ways. And if you look at shells and look at how they're made, they come in an extraordinary array of shapes and sizes and arrangements. And it's been a kind of question in people's minds for hundreds of years as to how the mollusks make their shells. And is there some kind of mathematical elegance that underlies those shapes that we can try and understand and copy, if you like? So this question of how mollusks make their shells goes back a long way. One of the first people to think about this was René Descartes, in the 17th century French philosopher, and he came up with a fundamental, sort of nailed down one part of the shell's elegance and beauty, which is the logarithmic spiral. And this is a log spiral. It's essentially a spiral that spins out from the middle and expands at a constant rate. And we see log spirals all through nature. It's the shape that a spiraling galaxy makes, the log spiral, the seeds in the head of a sunflower, the path of a doomed moth flying towards a candle flame. They all kind of trace the same sort of pattern. And you can see it here in the shell of a chambered nautilus. So this is a mollusk that lives in the deep ocean. And if you cut through their shells, you can see why it's called a chambered nautilus. It has these chambers through it. But you can see that it does form the shape of a log spiral. And it is a fundamental part of many, many shells. In two dimensions, you can see that their worlds are expanding outwards and getting bigger. And it means that no matter how big or small the shell is, it's the same shape. So that's kind of a key, one of the key rules that Descartes uncovered for shell making was this log spiral. But that's two dimensions. How about three dimensions? How are shells made in this beautiful three-dimensional shape? You know, there are some shells which are quite flat, but you'll, I'm sure, will have seen snail shells, shells of the beach that have a third dimension. And it was a long while later, in the beginning of the 20th century, a scientist called Darcy Wentworth Thompson wrote a book called On Growth and Form. And he was trying to understand the mathematics behind all sorts of shapes in nature, from the shape of a water, splash of water, to a deer's antlers, and shells. And he came up with the idea that maybe you could make shells with basically four simple mathematical rules. One is this, the logarithmic spiral. And the other three, he understood the idea of a shell being a two-dimensional shape, probably a circle, spinning around in three dimensions. So if you imagine a central axis and a circle which, as it goes down, is itself getting bigger, but it's spinning around that central axis and tracing out the shape of a shell. And then if you adjust the rate at which the shell drops down that axis, that's one of the rules. If you adjust the rate at which it expands outwards, how big it gets, how flared out it gets, that's another rule. And then you can decide how much the sort of the worlds, as they get bigger, squashing on each other. And this will hopefully all make sense in a second. Anyway, so he had these four ideas of how perhaps that would give us all the shells. If you just change those four parameters, you stick with the logarithmic spiral and you have this shape spinning around in three dimensions, maybe that would make all the shells. But he only left it as an idea. All he could do was he drew a few diagrams with pen and paper, and he kind of thought this seemed right, but he couldn't test it. And that's where he left it. And then about 40 years later, in the 1950s, a paleontologist called David Raup came along, and he picked up these ideas from Thomson, and he wanted to test out if this really is the case, if you could really make all these shells from simple mathematical rules. And he did something unusual for a paleontologist at the time. He used a computer. And I can actually show a picture of it at this point, but I've got to put it in my presentation. But he used the kind of computer that would have filled this whole room, a mainframe IBM type computer, which was invented, really was there to invent spacecraft and nuclear reactors and big things like that. But he borrowed a bit of time overnight to make shells. And he got these equations that Thomson had created and changed them a little bit. Essentially, they were the same. And he inputted a whole bunch of different parameters, different values for those parameters, into this model, into a computer model. And then essentially he traced out the shells that those parameters would make. And he did this in two dimensions, and then it was sort of rendered into three dimensions by an artist. It made the front cover of Science magazine. Because he showed that, yes, Thomson was right. You can basically make a whole load of different shells with those four simple rules. Luckily today we don't have to imagine what that looks like because people have made models, computer models, and an output of it. So essentially that's what we're doing here, is slowly changing those four rules. And as you can see, hopefully, it is incredible how those shells kind of morph into each other and how you can get, so this looks kind of like a chamber nautilus, but if you change the whirl rate so it expands very quickly, you get a clam. So clam shells, the bivalves, they do have spiraling shells, they just expand really rapidly, and that's how you get that shape. So as you tweak those parameters, you get all of these incredible shells. And so Thomson was right, and that was wonderful, but actually opened up a whole new area of science, this discovery, that really wasn't expected, which is that all of the shells that David Raup made in this model, not all of them actually exist in the natural world. Even extinct shells or living shells today, mollusks today. He built what's kind of coined the term the museum of all possible shells. So the output of his model was this kind of this morphospace, this imaginary room filled with all the shells that there possibly could be. But he discovered that it's not full of real shells. Like, not all of them have evolved. There's a big difference between what's potential in shell making, if you like, and what's actually evolved. And this has opened a whole area of research into evolution of structures in the natural world. So what's possible and what actually evolves. And there were some parts of the museum that wouldn't have made sense. There are shells that just wouldn't be adaptable at all, ever. There were clams that wouldn't open, shells that were clearly just too big and heavy and would never have been an advantage to have, so they would never have evolved. But there are plenty that look kind of feasible, but just haven't evolved. And there's still a kind of divide between researchers who... and experts and evolutionary biologists who think different reasons explain this. Maybe it's that sometime they will evolve, it just hasn't happened, that the situation has arisen where that shell has made sense and it has evolved because it was more adaptive than another shape. And there are others who think that there isn't the potential there, there's something limiting, something else that's limiting the evolution of shell shapes, which means you don't get the shell. So, and imaginary museums for all sorts of other animals, like for plants and fish and plankton and all sorts of things, and looking at this idea of what could happen and what actually happens is a kind of powerful evolutionary tool now. And I just think that's really mesmerising. I might have to show you that one more time. Oops, not going. Okay, let's move on. So, I'm often asked, mostly by children, But they ask the best questions. What's my favourite mollusk? And it's difficult because it's thought there could be 200,000 species of mollusk. They are, after the insects and the arthropods, they are the most diverse phylum. This is a phylum if you're a big grouping of the animal kingdom. So there's lots to choose from. But well, one of my absolute favourites is this guy, the Argonaut, which you may have noticed I always have on my t-shirts. And there's a story behind this which I'll tell you in a bit. But yeah, Argonauts are fabulous mollusks. They are the only octopus that have shells. All the rest have a shell-free life and have evolved other ways of living and protecting themselves without that kind of hard outer covering. And one of the reasons I think really it's my favourite creature is because of the uncertainty about what these animals were going back hundreds of years. And that, again, there was a lot of talk about what are these animals? How do they make their shells? Do they make their shells or not? And it goes back to Aristotle, who was one of the first people to write about argonauts. These things do live in the Mediterranean, so he could have seen them, people might have brought them to him. And he set in motion a myth that continued for a very long time, which was that these octopus use their shells to keep boats. I should say another name for the argonauts is the paper nautilus. We saw a picture of the chamber nautilus just now. They actually aren't that closely related, but if you do see a nautilus shell, I don't have one sadly, I don't have to have one, but they do look a bit like a chambered nautilus shell, but they're much lighter. They're still calcium carbonate, but they're very papery. So the other name is the paper nautilus. And there were stories about how these animals would float on the surface of the water in their little paper shells and use them as boats and stick two of their arms, because octopus have eight arms, two of them in the air and hold them out flat as sails and let them drift across the ocean on the surface of the water, sailing on their beautiful boats, in their little boats. And actually, there's if you've read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by Jules Verne, he has a scene where the marine biologist Professor Aronnax comes to the surface and pops up from his submarine, which he's been captured in. The submarine's called the Nautilus, actually, which is quite cool. And they see this raft of argonauts coming past, and they've all got their little sails up and they're sailing past. So clearly, Jules had kind of perpetuated this story from Aristotle's time onwards. And all these for hundreds of years, the marine biologists swore that they saw this happening. And we know that that's not what they do, and we know what's going on with it. So this is one of their arms, and it was sort of assumed that that was this sail part. But there are also stories that they used their arms as rowing to row themselves along, that the other six arms were like a jump. So there are all these stories about argonauts and what they use their shells for, and that was one side of the kind of debate about argonauts. The other is whether or not the octopus inside those shells actually make them themselves or steal their shells from other animals and then maybe even eat the animal that was inside the shell and then nick the shell and sail off into the sunset. And this really was a big debate that was discussed and was really eminent scientists, largely in the 19th century, so beginning of the 19th century onwards, was, what are these animals? People would find these shells on expeditions as they went off, as these explorers went off to explore the world, and they'd find argonauts drifting around in the ocean and or fish them out in nets, and they would find an octopus inside, but it comes all the way out. You can take an argonaut all the way out of its shell, unlike a snail. If you do that with a snail, it's not going to go back in. They are stuck to their shells. They don't come out. But the argonaut does. And they really genuinely were like, oh, we don't know. They named these as two different things. The octopus is one species, the shell is another, and they had different names for them both. But no one really got to the bottom of this. What animal did they steal their shells from? We haven't seen one of those alive yet. Ah, but we haven't seen a chambered nautilus alive yet. We just find their empty shells. That could have maybe something like that. Back then, there were lots of things. We're still very mysterious. Please clean the filter. I don't know how to clean the filter, so just that won't be a problem. I wanted to write about argonauts in the book, really, because I wanted to introduce this lady. Jeanvive Prepau was a wonderful French lady. She grew up in a fairly poor family in a village in France in the turn of the 19th century. She then walked to Paris, where she was to become a seamstress. She made the wedding dress for a princess. And then at the wedding party, met a man who became a husband, who was a wealthy chap from Sicily. They moved back to Sicily. But instead of carrying on with her work as a seamstress or just being a lady of leisure, she rolled up her sleeves and became a scientist. And I really think she was like a kind of Gerald Durrell of her age. She really was kind of fascinated by all aspects of the natural world. And she would bring animals into her house to study. But she's not very well remembered. And she really was a pioneer in marine biology, which is really wanted to bring out her character in the book and to talk about how she decided to answer this question finally about argonauts and do they make their shells or not. And she did it through a series of really cool experiments, which she got lots of live argonauts that were in the Mediterranean, and built observation tanks. So she kind of built the first aquariums, basically, which she then used to observe these animals in. There's some lovely experiments, which I write about in the book. And came to the conclusion that, yes, they do make their own shells. They aren't the pirates of the ocean stealing boats from other animals. They do make their own. And it's actually those, the kind of the webs or the sails on those arms. This is what makes the shell. And it's the females that do it. Which is different to all the other mollusks. Most of the mollusks make their shells through a layer of tissue across them. It's called the mantle, which is kind of like over the body. If you've ever eaten mussels, the kind of pink bit inside of the mussel, that's the mantle, and that will secrete the shell. Whereas argonauts do it differently. With the end of their arms, they make the shells. And she just had these really elegant experiments to show that this was the case, that argonauts do make the shells. And since then, we're still finding out loads about these animals. It's quite elusive, so they're quite hard to find. They do live in the open sea. You can't make an appointment to meet an argonaut. You just happen to be in the right place at the right time. But we do now know that they don't float around on the surface in their shells, but they do use their shells to help them float underwater. They keep little bubbles of air inside their shell, and it helps to reduce their weight and keep them buoyant as they swim down through the open ocean. So very cool. Lots of still things we don't know about argonauts. But yeah, that's one reason, couple of good reasons I think why argonauts deserve to be my favourite one. Another story of a mollusk researcher who's not very well remembered and who I wanted to bring to life in the book is this guy. From a similar sort of era, I should say that Jean Villepin-Pau was doing all this in the 1830s, 1840s. A similar sort of time, this guy, Hugh Cumming, was embarking on amazing journeys of exploration to fulfil his lifelong dream. He grew up in Devon, again in a fairly poor family, had this kind of glorious dream. He wanted to collect more shells than anyone ever had. So I write a chapter in the book about shell collecting, because I think that's the sort of, it's the most obvious thing that all of us probably at some point maybe collected some shells when we've been to the beach, or just picked a few up and taken them home, and then found them ages later, and, you know, sort of that little reminder of a day in a different place. And, you know, obviously people who take shell collecting very seriously and devote themselves to it, and there's something about wanting to have them and keep them that I think is quite universal. So I explore that a bit in the book. And the central character is this guy, Hugh Cumming. And he extraordinarily religiously went on. So he had this dream, he wanted to collect more shells than anybody. But this wasn't just, it wasn't just a sort of throwaway kind of dream. It tapped into what was happening at the time. This was an era, end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, when people were going out into the world and understanding more and more about biodiversity, where species were, the fact that if you go somewhere new, you would find new animals, new species you didn't find back home. And just this idea of what we now think of as biogeography, you know, the biology of geography, if you like, where you find things and where they live. And he tapped into this idea. So, you know, you want to find more shells that no one else has found, well, you go to places where people haven't been yet, where shell collectors haven't been. So he wound up, he made himself some money in the shipping industry, and then he retired early, sort of in his early 30s, had a boat built for him, the Discoverer, a little wooden schooner, which he kitted out for collecting shells. It was probably the first sort of purpose-built scientific vessel, a research vessel that had ever been made. And he, by that point, he was living in Chile, and he decided to set off into the Pacific. And he went on the first of a series of incredible voyages. It was just him and another guy called Captain Grimwood. Just two of them. It set him apart from a lot of the other explorers at the time, like Darwin, who were going off on these grand voyages on big ships, which were supported by the government or by things like the Royal Society, with loads of money and big crews. And he was self-funded, and he basically went on his own, and was just kind of one by one collecting all these shells that he wanted to find. And in some of his diaries are still available, so I looked at those and looked at some of the things he was writing about. And it wasn't all about shells for him. He was clearly quite the explorer. He enjoyed meeting people in all these, you know, he was basically island hopping to Tahiti and back from Chile. He went partying with the Queen of Tahiti. He encountered lots of natives, lots of missionaries, lots of whaling, because basically the only Westerners in that part of the world at that time were catching whales or trying to spread the word of God. And he talks a lot about that. He collected nose flutes. He did all sorts of cool things. But it wasn't all smooth, plain sailing. I'd like to read you just a little bit from the book. One thing that kind of struck me, what was interesting about what he got up to, was that he didn't... he only collected shells from the beech tree. He never went diving. And at this point, I think later on he started to collect shells with little nets in them, sort of from the seabed. But really, he just kind of gleaned along the shore. Except one time when he got wet, which I'm going to read for you now. Not everywhere they went were coming in Grimwood, welcomed by friendly locals and expat missionaries. In some places, they were met with ferocious war dances, blood-curdling yells, and displays of menacing weapons. On Timo Island, in the southeastern fringes of the Tuamotu archipelago, a clumsy scene unfolded that could have ended in disaster. Cumming and Grimwood, along with four locals hired from a nearby island, were rowing in a small boat towards the beach when two islanders spotted them and dashed down to the water's edge, spears in hand. It was Captain Grimwood's idea to frighten them off by firing a few musket shots over their heads. All this did was draw a bigger crowd of shouting, dancing men wearing war helmets topped with feathers, their bodies painted black and white. Spying a gap in the coral reef on the other side of the lagoon, Cumming's small crew tried to make their escape, but encountered a wide stretch of dry sand and rocks between them and their exit. Their only option was to pick up the boat and scuttle as fast as they could towards the open water, while the islanders swarmed after them. Even when they reached the water, Cumming and his men were still not unclear. A wave broke over the side of the boat, capsizing it, scattering their belongings in the sea. Cumming was flipped out of his seat, the boat landed on his leg, knocked him unconscious, and he sank to the bottom. Rescue came from one of their hired hands, who swam down and dragged the sodden Cumming back to the surface. The crew righted the boat, only for Cumming to get washed overboard and rescued a second time. The islanders ignored the commotion in the sea because they were too busy fishing out the hats, jackets, oars, collecting baskets and bottles that had fallen out of their own boat and were floating towards the beach. It's quite possible that Cumming and Grimwood were imagining the savagery of the Timo Islanders, and clearly the two groups of people were bemused and confused by what the other was up to. So, yes, he had some quite fun adventures. After his Pacific voyage, he then travelled along the south coast, the Pacific coast of South America. He went to the Galapagos Islands a few years before Darwin. He then came back to London for a little while and started to set himself up as a shell trader. One thing he never did was he never actually described scientifically any of the shells he collected. I should say that I think he was driven by the desire to describe the species and to figure out just how many shells there are, not just as trinkets, although that was part of how he made his money, was selling duplicate shells to just general collectors. But he made his collections available to other scientists who then would describe the species, and thousands of new species were discovered through his collections, and loads were named after him, like Camungii is this species name on just masses of new species. He also went for 3 years to the Philippines, again a place where not really anyone had been collecting shells before. He found just a treasure trove of new species. And ultimately he came back to London, and he had achieved his dream. He had found more shells than anyone ever had before, was a single person at least. And they ended up in the Natural History Museum. And one of the things I wanted to do when I was researching the book was to go and find his shells in the museum. So I had a really fun time. I was invited by, well, I got myself an invitation, by the mollusk department in the Natural History Museum. And they took me behind the scenes. So basically underneath the dinosaur is the mollusk section. You get to go through a little door downstairs. And there are just rooms and rooms and rooms of wooden cabinets with little, you open the doors and little drawers, and there's just masses. They think there's about 8 million shells, but no one's actually counted them because they don't have a single catalogue for them, as I discovered. And I was rather expecting them to sort of say, oh yes, come this way, come on, show you Cumming's shells over here, here are all his shells in one place. But they're actually dispersed through the whole collection. what happened when he finally gave this collection after his death, they were finally sold to a museum. They were basically species by species, kind of group by group. They were put in amongst all the other shells. So they've been kind of incorporated into the collection, which I think is even better, really. It's sort of, it's they're part of the working collection that's still being used today by researchers and people in the museum. So basically the guy was like, well, the curator was like, open a drawer, see if you can find some of his shells. And so we're just rummaging through them, and you can see basically there's little scraps of paper on each of the shells which tell you who collected it and where it came from, and you can see the letters MS, signed for museum coming, which was his little stamp for this were my shells. And they're all the way through the collection, you can find them really quite easily. Which is quite amazing to see. And then the final thing I saw in the museum, which kind of connected the whole thing together, was a beautiful series of books called the Conchologia Iconica, which is about 20 volumes, I think, of these beautifully illustrated books from the same era. And loads of the shells that were illustrated by a friend of Cummings, Lovell Weave, were based on his collections. And the book, you can see, has descriptions of where the shells come from, and loads of them are Cummings shells. And it was such exquisitely drawn. This was a style of lithography which was actually much more advanced than what anyone else was doing at the time. These were published, I think, from the 1840s and 50s. You can actually figure out which individual shell from the collection was drawn. So there's one in particular, the type of cone snail, which we talked about a lot in the book, in his diaries. And then you can find the shell in the collection, you can find the drawing in the book, and you know it's the same shell that he found and it's been illustrated. It's really beautiful. And these books are still really useful for all sorts of research into what's been collected. Art historians are using these books. It's a really wonderful kind of record of what was going on at the time. And the names of the species they found, the common names, it's just really fun to see. I think there's a kind of a joy to science that perhaps we don't always see nowadays. It just gets a bit serious, whereas back then people did clearly have a lot of fun finding species and describing what's going on in the natural world. But nowadays, of course, we don't have to draw shells or any other biological specimens. We've got photography, which came along after this. We do things like take pictures like this. These mollusks were all found last summer in Papua New Guinea, and they're all less than 5 millimeters. They're micromollusks, which probably is where the treasure trove of new species that we still haven't uncovered is in the mollusk world. That's where it lies. In these little, beautiful species of snails and clams, are mostly in the tropics. So yeah, these ones from Papua New Guinea. And they're still uncovering a huge diversity of shells. To the point where actually none of these have been described by scientists. They are what's known as orphan species. It's a big problem with a lack of expertise. We don't have enough people who know how to identify particular groups of animals. So they're collected, and then great expeditions go out, which I'll tell you about in a second. But often they come back to the museums and they sit on a shelf for, I think, something like an average age, like 30 years it takes to describe species. And they sit there, discovered but not named. And that's just an example of those. The photograph came from a guy called Philippe Boucher from the Natural History Museum in Paris, who I spoke to. He's one of the leading experts. He's kind of the Hugh Cumming of today, really. He leads these exhibitions specifically to go and find as many mollusks as possible, and he goes to extraordinary places and has some really wonderful ways of finding mollusks, which I want to just read to you another little bit from the book about modern-day mollusk collecting. In the summer of 2014, Philippe Boucher led a team of mollusk hunters to Navo, an island off the coast of Papua New Guinea, which lies in a coral-dotted lagoon stretching between the Bismarck Sea and the Pacific Ocean. This spot lies towards the eastern end of the Coral Triangle, a place where there are more marine species than anywhere else on the planet. Throughout years of field trips in Vanuatu, Madagascar, the Philippines and elsewhere, Boucher and colleagues from dozens of countries have been honing their collecting techniques. Divers venture out both day and night so as not to miss the nocturnal species. They drop sampling devices down to varying depths where, like layers of a forest canopy, different assemblies of animals are found. They search between the tides. They even check among the spines of sea urchins and the tube feet of starfish, parasitic snails, that suck the echinoderm's bodily fluids. The teams have also begun taking snippets of tissue to preserve the animal's DNA, so species can be identified from the genetic fingerprint. Using this suite of meticulous methods, the collectors are probing deeper than ever into the world of mollusks. In particular, they're uncovering an incalculable trove of micromollusks. These weeny animals are truly the secret gems of the sea. They come in a riot of exquisite colours, like a jar of jelly beans, with neon spots and stripes, yellow, purple, green, and red. Almost nothing is known about these animals. We don't know what they eat, what eats them, what strange and useful molecules they might contain, or where exactly they belong on the sprawling tree of molluscan life. There are so few experts who specialise in these minute species that many of the samples Boucher and the team collect could remain for years on the museum shelf, found and logged but not fully identified. Divers from Boucher's team went gathering mollusks along a vertical wall. Even greater mysteries remain to be unravelled, hidden in the oceanic nooks where mollusks reside, but no one has yet worked out how to get hold of them. Divers from Boucher's team went gathering mollusks along a vertical wall of coral that plunges into the Bismarck Sea off Nago, 1,000 metres beneath the waves. The wall is pockmarked with caves, inside which divers found a tantalising array of previously unknown shells, all of them between 1 and 5 millimetres in size, and all of them empty and dead. No matter how hard they tried and how carefully they looked, they couldn't find a single living mollusk responsible for making these enigmatic shells. The animals probably live deep within the cracks of this towering wall. The only reason we know they exist at all is because their shells drop down into the hands of the diving scientists, and we can only imagine what else lives in there, out of reach and out of sight. So that's just a little taste of the discoveries that are going on in the mollusk world today. That's just about all I want to talk to you about. I do, just briefly before I finish, want to come back to the title of the book and my t-shirt, which I promise I won't tell you about. We were having a real tough time deciding what to call the book, to the point where I've nearly finished writing it, and my editor was like, "You've really got to decide, because we have to start telling people, like the booksellers, what this is going to be called." Really, you've got to decide. So I'm like, just okay. We've gone through lots of things that didn't work, and it just wasn't happening. I just needed a few more days. There was a phase where I was convinced that the book should be called The Flight of the Argonauts, because I was obsessed with Argonauts when I was writing a chapter about Jean-Pierre Power and the whole thing about how they make their shells. And all I could see was Argonauts. And I was like, please, can we have Flight of the Argonauts? And I was trying to make a case for that. And that kind of brings me to how we got to collaborate with the guy who did the artwork for the book. So Argonauts were on my mind. I couldn't think of anything else. I was looking around online for pictures of Argonauts, and I found that picture I showed you before, the same as my t-shirt. Discovered that it was drawn by an artist called John Aaron Gregory from San Francisco. Found his website and discovered he's a fantastic illustrator who was a marine biologist, was now retraining as an artist, was just as nuts as I am about ocean creatures. And I was like, I want him to do the cover, and I want it to be Argonauts, please. So we got in touch with him. Thankfully, everything just kind of fell in place. He was just like, from the word go. He'd just been on holiday when we first emailed him. He'd just been away on an island off the coast of California, and he'd found an Argonaut shell on the beach. He sings in a band called Giant Squid, for goodness sake. He was perfect. We had to have him. But yes, he agreed, luckily. And I started saying, we started exchanging ideas, and I was like, okay, can we have some Argonauts on the cover, please? That would be great. I'm going to show you some sketches that he did and sort of show you how we got to the cover that we ended up having. Because I don't think you get to see this sort of thing, it's quite fun. So first of all, it's all about Argonauts. He gave us some sketches. I think they're really cute. I particularly like this one here. It's sort of an interesting angle. So we started talking Argonauts. But then my editor was like, no, not Argonauts. It's not a book about Argonauts. It'll mislead readers. It's not what it's about. The reason I wanted it to be Flight of the Argonauts was because this idea of them using air bubbles inside their shells to, as a kind of almost as an underwater hot air balloon to give them buoyancy. So they do fly through the oceans to some degree. But no, our mums had to go, unfortunately. So we didn't call it that. We didn't have our mums exclusively on the cover. There is one. And then, yeah, it was really coming down to the wire of, like, you've really got to decide on this title. And I was like, can I just have a few more days? I'm going to go on holiday to North Devon for a few days. I will be on a beach with mollusks. Maybe I'll show you. So we went there, and it was lovely. And I was literally just, I mean, my friends and my husband would say that it was just like, God, I can just decide, please. It's just, we need to get this done. I mean, we'd been, as you do on holiday, we'd been collecting specimens on the beach, brought them back to look under our microscope, which we brought with us on holiday, yes. And looking at some lovely mollusks, micro mollusks we found amongst the seaweed. And I just thought, oh, well, you know, they're spiraling shapes. How about spirals in time? Because, you know, they've been around for a long time. Does that work? And my editor was like, yes, spirals in time is fine. Let's have that. Okay, good. And like, I still use my mum's subtitle. Brilliant. Spirals in time, it is fantastic. So then we went back to Erin with new ideas of what could be on the cover, and it just opened up all the possibilities. It could be anything out. And initially, I basically said there were two things I really wanted to have on the front cover. I wanted lots of species. I really wanted to capture this idea of mollusks being incredibly diverse. You know, it's all sorts of creatures in all sorts of lives that they lead. So lots of different mollusks, please. And I want them to be alive. I really don't want this to be a book about boring dirt shells. I wanted it to be a book about living, extraordinary animals that do crazy things. So, living, please, and lots of species. So, Erin did some sketches. First of all, we came up with this one. So, this is the two covers, the front and the back. My editor thought it was a bit much, maybe a bit too much going on. No space for text. We need more space for text, apparently. And then he, actually, my editor, Jim Martin, it was his idea. He's like, well, why don't we have a spiral of mollusks? Aha, a spiral in time, a spiral, we actually have a spiral of mollusks. That was his idea. So the next sketch were these two. Okay, do you want a spiral that comes out at you, or one from the top? I should say that this was a really fun part of the book. I was just finishing off writing it at this point, and we were pinging emails to San Francisco and back, and you know, Erin would do a sketch and send it back an email. I'd be like, oh, this is nice. And it kind of carried on, as you'll see, as we did the rest of the illustrations. Like eagerly awaiting the next instalment of what my book was going to look like. So we went for coming out at you in the middle. He then did a sketch of the front and the back, and this was really interesting. I haven't done art since I did my GCSE, so I don't know what advances there have been. But the way he did it, he just drew it in pencil first, and then painted it in with ink by hand, and then he coloured it in on a computer. Who knew? So all the colours are digital on a tablet, so there and doing this colouring in. And then we had various possibilities for the cover, colours put forward, so we had a look, and we pretty much unanimously decided that we liked this one, as it is. And it was a lovely thing to be involved in doing the cover. It wasn't the case for my first book. I was just told, oh, here's the cover, there we are. I don't like it, too bad, you have to put up with it. Can we make it blue, not brown? Okay, we can make it blue, not brown. That was the only thing I got to decide on the first book with the seahorse that I wrote, was the colour, everything else was decided. Whereas Bloom's Root were very, very nice and nice to be involved, so it's great. So yeah, that's the front cover, and then we've got Erin to do an illustration for each of the chapters to illustrate the subjects, and so here's just a few of those. This is the one about cone snails, this is my cone snail attacking fish with its poisons, which are lovely. These are sea butterflies, which are these minute little snails that, instead of having a single foot and crawling around the seabed, have split their feet in two and they fly around in the open sea on little wings. So the chapter about those guys and how climate change could really be bad news for them in the not too distant future. And this one is the biggest ammonite that ever existed, Parapososia. So ammonites are an extinct group of mollusks. There's a whole chapter about how fabulous they were. In association with the Argonauts, actually, there's an intriguing link between the two, which I shall leave there tantalising. You're going to have to read the book to find what it is. But this guy was 3 metres in diameter. I mean, they were absolutely enormous. These are sharks at the bottom to show you the scale of it. Absolutely massive. We don't actually know what they looked like. Their bodies, there's never been a soft part of an ammonite fossilised. We've seen loads of shells. We sort of assume they probably looked a bit like squid and octopus today. And then finally, the end papers. Again, this is something I didn't get in my first book, which was I really wanted to have the beginning and the end of the book with little seahorses for the seahorse book, but I was told, no, it's not happening. But this time, Bloomsbury said, yes, we can have it in papers. So I basically chose the Wentworth trap snail because they have these beautiful spiralling sculpted shells, and I wanted them to be roughly life-size and have them falling all over the cover. So if you get a copy of the hardback, and there are some available this evening if you would like some, you'll have some beautiful shells, snails crawling around. Or an octopus. they're the only ones that kind of come in that category of clever, thoughtful, sensitive things. So they are extraordinary creatures, and they do have, they've got incredible cognitive abilities. They clearly sense the world and interact in a way that a bivalve isn't. I mean, clams are probably the less, you know, clams and mussels don't have much going on upstairs. They don't have anything we can recognise the brain, but they do have eyes. You know, giant clams can see. They can detect light and dark, and they have scallops. If you see a live scallop, you'll see little dots around the edge of its mantle. Those are its eyes. So, you know, they can sense the world around them. But generally, it's thought that certainly the bivalves are not really anywhere near an octopus in terms of its thinking and responding. And in fact, there are vegans who argue that it's okay to eat oysters because they're so unanimal-like that it's fine. I don't quite follow the argument through and says that surely the vegan doesn't want to eat any animals, but they seem they really are the true sea vegetables of the animal world, that they have so little ability to sense the world around them that maybe it's fine to eat them. Octopus and squid as well, these are incredible things. I don't eat those guys. I spent the summer in Madagascar, and in a place where everyone just eats octopus. It's pretty much the staple diet was octopus. And we started eating a lot of octopus, and I'm never a big fan anyway of eating octopus, but then I met one day when we were out in the bay, and after that I was like, oh, it's so cool. He was watching me as much as I was watching it, and it was just changing its colour and hiding in sand, and I was like, oh, I'm done.
Do you think there's is there an evolutionary advantage there to this spiral across? I mean, like razor shells, they're not spiral.
Well, they would originally kind of, because they're bivalves, the razor clams, with the long thin shells you get. So I think a nickname for them is witch's fingernails. You get them on the beach. And bivalves. You know, as we saw in that video, you do get a kind of clam-like shape by adjusting these four parameters. And there will, I mean, it'd be very hard to find it, but there is a spiral in there somewhere, but probably one is, like the other clams, it's just rolled out so quickly. It's the way that mollusks make their shells, I should have said this actually, is that they keep their shells their whole life, so unlike crabs and shrimp, crustaceans which make a new shell and throughout their lives and cast off the old one and make a new one size bigger. Mollusks keep their shells and they just make them bigger as they get bigger inside. And that's partly why it's expanding circle and expanding shape. And it's just literally kind of those patterns emerge from, they twist, I don't know where that comes from, that's obviously just their genetic programming to twist around this axis. Sometimes not just one axis. There are some mollusks that live in Malaysia on land which have four axes of spirals. They kind of go this way for a bit, then they go this way for a bit, then they go this way. And they kind of throw the whole book out. So they are all these beautiful, simple spirals. It's kind of the basis that then gets twisted. So there's a bunch of shells that never have fitted into that museum, really. But it's incredible it's the basis that's then tweaked and changed. You know, there are lots of other bits you stick on shells, those shells are the spiny ones, that's an extra addition. But it fits into that kind of basic model of how shells make themselves. But just expanding as they get bigger. So if you looked at a razor clam, you could probably see growth lines going down the length of it. Because they also make their shells in stops and starts. They don't constantly make material, it's kind of a seasonal thing. So you can count the rings on a shell like a tree. Especially clams, you can actually, if you look at a cockle shell or clam shell, you can see there'll be lots of lines, but the deeper ones, generally the annual shells, so you can count how old they are, by sort of the biggest lines.
So is the spiral, you mentioned the spiral, something that throughout the physical world, right out into the cosmos, is something constant, you know, something that it's somehow the way the world works.
It's just a kind of an emergent property of an expansion in two dimensions, I guess. It's, you know, it's hard to kind of grasp that, but for some reason it's spinning and getting bigger. If something spins and gets bigger at a constant rate, it makes this spiral, I guess. Kind of like a hard to get your head around, but it is weird that it's so universal that you see all over the place.
Never finish.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where, you know, no matter how big or small, it looks the same shape. You know, it's sort of a baby shell, it's the same shape as an adult shell. It's just a different size. So, you know, it's sort of how close are you standing to it? It's the same shape, but just different scale. So, yeah.
Are individuals within the same or very similar species, do they always have spiral shells that go the same way? So right-handed or left-handed?
That's a great question. The left-handed, right-handed thing is really cool. I do write about that. So, weirdly, at the moment, basically most shells are right-handed. So if you look, if you've got a sample of seashells and looked at which way they spin. And, you know, I think there is a way of working out which way a bivalve spins, but I'm not quite sure if I did it myself, but you can figure out which way it goes. They spin to the right, so if you look at it from the top, it was spinning clockwise. And it's about the same proportion as there are right-handed people, but for a completely different reason. It's just a kind of random fact that it's not the same genes that are controlling spiraling of shells as are handedness. But basically, it comes down to the idea that all respective shells need to be the same, whether it's one way or the other, no matter which way, because of the way they mate with each other. And they need to have shells that, and bodies, their bodies are also asymmetric, and it's about how their genital pores and overlap each other. And if they're opposite, the way they mate means they basically can't physically mate with each other. If it's left and right handed snail, we've done loads of experiments where you put snails that are right handed and snails that are left handed together, and no matter how hard they try, they don't have babies, or at least they have very few babies. It's quite difficult. So it's a real advantage to have everyone the same. You do get mutants, though, so you do get some that turn up that will spin the other way. There's various ways that can happen. One, actually, if you think about that, so that spiral that we looked at, one way that you get the other spiraling is if the axis goes the other way. Can I go? So rather than spinning down, if it spins upwards, then it's actually, and it can happen embryologically, that as it's developing, it kind of pokes in rather than comes out at you, and that means it spins in the other direction. So that happens sometimes. And then you do get some species that are left-handed, and there are good reasons for, in some situations, why it makes sense to be left-handed rather than right-handed. But if you do find a left-handed snail here, it would probably be, there are some freshwater snails that are left-handed, but on the whole, they're right-handed. And there's like trades, like so people who still collect shells today, there's like people are kind of crazy for the left-handed oddities and they're picking more than one another. But in the past, people would kind of doctor shells to make them look like they're left-handed, and it's actually they're not, they're just kind of cut it off and snap it back on. Therefore, it's worth way more money because it's a rare left-handed specimen. So, yeah, it's
sorry. Sorry, Kerry, yeah. So, what's up? You said there were these four variables for which given the entire part of the shells. Must be quite a simple developmental mechanism then.
In terms of
genes and.
I don't quite know if we do know exactly how. The shell, kind of how the mollusk orients itself to create a spiral and how that happens. I suspect it's one of those things that really no one's looked into in a huge amount of detail. There is definitely a gene that people know which influences the left-handed right-handedness. And we do have that gene, it's quite an ancient gene, and it doesn't dictate our left-handedness, but I think it's the asymmetry in our bodies, like our heart on the left. Exactly how it's programmed, how small is the program to make their shells, I don't know. But there does seem to be this very ancient, and you know, it goes back to the first mollusks that there were, but the first fossils had these spiraling shells, but clearly it was something that was put in place a long time ago. But if you don't really see it in here, I don't know, do you see spirals in other organisms? Like, they do occasionally pop up, like there are crazy sharks with spiraling jaws, fossil sharks, helicoprions that have these weird jaw things, which is a similar sort of spiral. But it clearly is a fundamental part of the world. But to be honest, I don't know much about the shells that comes about. One thing I did to sort of find in going down certain avenues of research in the book is speaking to people was the idea that there were lots of questions about moss that aren't really getting answered just because there's not really funding for that kind of thing. So a story that leads on from the shapes of shells is the patterns of shells. And I spoke to some guys who are doing some really cool stuff about the kind of mathematics of the beautiful pattern on shells. And they've got these ideas that they're under nervous control, and that actually it's a kind of a marketplace for shells, for mollusks to know where to come back to kind of get back in place to carry on making the shells. It's a reminder of where they were. But they haven't tested this. And the guys were like, you try getting funding for this kind of thing. Like, you try persuade research groups. I mean, there are things that come off of that, you know. He reckons that you could start thinking about more about how more complex nervous systems work by studying these simple ones, but still they haven't done it. There are a lot of questions that could be answered, but that's just not where the priorities are at the moment. So.
Can you speed the process up? So I'm thinking that there might be a commercial pressure, for example, to get mussels to grow faster. Speed up the rate at which they grow their shells.
That's a good question, actually. I'm sure that sort of thing has probably been done. I don't know how much there's been kind of captive breeding and, similar thing to plants to try and make really big, fast growing oysters and so on. I don't know, might be. I think sadly, a lot of the research at the moment is looking at kind of the opposite of that, and how acidification of the oceans is slowing down growth or messing up shell fisheries and so on. Although some do seem to do a bit better when there's more CO2, it's quite a mixed picture with acidification actually. It's not just everything is going to start melting and be bad. There actually are some mollusks that seem to do quite well with higher CO2 levels, so it's not clear cut. I'm sure that farmers will have thought of ways of trying to grow it really quickly. I don't know. Most of the stuff I did for the book was looking at wild caught shellfish and oysters and mussels and things that were just left in the sea to grow and pulled out, and while they were tinkering with them, I'm sure someone would do it.
Kind of, but I just basically got told something a long time ago. I want to know if it was true, also how it happened.
Okay.
I was told that shells could be shown to show how fast the Earth rotates, kind of like on a speed basis. Oh. And over like many, many years, you can see the Earth has actually slowed down how quickly it turns.
Okay, haven't heard this, but
sorry,
it's possible. if it's linked to tidal patterns. Would the tide be changed by the rate?
They said it according to the moon, so I guess.
So there's a link to the moon. And I do know that there are mollusks in which you can, mostly I think clams and cockles, where there are techniques in which you can actually see the layer of shell that laid down at a particular tide. And there's this paleontological techniques which can now do such tiny sort of microscopic analysis of slices of shell that you can actually say that these are the tides that happened, you know, thousands of years ago. So maybe it's true actually. So if you could trace the time between tides or the extent of the tides through a shell, then that could then link that to the proximity of that.
I would guess that if you could tell the length of the year from some feature of the shell, so we count the number of tidal layers per annum.
Yeah.
As easy as that. And the Earth did spin a lot faster over many, many hundreds of millions of years.
Hundreds of millions, okay. I mean, so mollusks have been around for 500 million years, so would that be enough?
Yes, it's conceivable.
I don't know how long they've been. It's possible. Yeah. I don't know how long they've been looking into tidal areas. You need to get the ones that live between the tides. I imagine they've probably been around for a long time. That's really cool. I've never heard of that. That's really interesting. Yeah, see, it's always an intense
thing. Makes sense. Something like that might be. I wonder if you get more fossil spirals going the other way at times when the Earth's priority was reversed.
Now, see, that's interesting because there is one reference I found to ammonites flipping between. There's eras when ammonites were right, and then eras when they were left-handed spinners. But no one in the poem has ever thought about that as a possibility, a possible explanation. But mostly, I think it's mostly that they're just stick with the right hand.
want to thank Helen. She has some books, I think, set back, and afterwards we're all going to go to the pub for King's Arms across the road. So, anyone wants to come and drink, then we'll be there.
Thank you.
Thank
you so much. Thank
you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Details of our upcoming events can be found at our website, www.oxfordsidebar.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Oxford Sidebar and on Facebook, British Science Association, Oxfordshire Branch.